Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Welcome to the Diary of a CEO, where we explore the intricacies of the human experience. In today's thought-provoking episode, we have a fascinating interview with a leading neuroscientist who delves into the relationship between our brains, emotions, and the realities we create. Together, they unravel the complexities of how our minds function and how understanding this can empower us to take control of our lives. Have you ever wondered how much agency you truly have over your thoughts and feelings? In this episode, we uncover the surprising ways in which our understanding of the brain can lead to a more intentional life. Get ready for insights that could change your perspective on everyday experiences. Let's begin.
You know, maybe they use it to entertain their friends at a dinner party. Maybe they use it to help their kid who's, you know, struggling with depression. That was certainly, in my case, something that I had to deal with. Maybe they're using it to improve their workplace or improve the productivity of their peeps or whatever. The point being that that's what science is for. It's for, you know, living a better life. And average everyday people without PhDs can do that if they have the right information. I'm probably attempting to understand how it is that a brain like ours that is attached to a body like ours, that is pickled in a world like ours, produces a mind. What is it? What is happening that allows you to have thoughts and feelings and memories and actions? And somebody from another country, another culture, also has a mental life which looks nothing like yours. How is it that the same kind of brain plan with the same general kind of body plan can produce such different types of minds when those brains are wired, in a sense, finish wiring themselves in cultural and physical contexts that are so widely different?
When you just talked about your pursuit of understanding how a brain like ours creates the mind and the reality that we have, if I'm able to understand all of that, as many people who read your book about the brain and emotions were able to understand, what is it that it offers me in my everyday life?
Oh my God, it offers you the opportunity to have more agency in your life.
And what does that mean?
It means you have more choice. It means you have more control. It means that you can architect your life. I mean, you can't control everything that happens to you. You can't control every moment of feeling. But you have more control than you probably think you do. Everybody has more control over what they feel and what they do than they think they do. That control doesn't look the way we expect it to. It's much harder to harness than we would like it to be. Some people have more opportunities for that control than other people do, but everybody has the opportunity to have more control. And of course, the flip side is also more responsibility for the way they live their lives. And I think that's a really good thing. And I think it's a really good thing now when, you know, world events are swirling around you and you feel like, you know, you're just being buffeted around. Even within that craziness, there are opportunities to be more of an architect of your own experience and your own life. I think a lot of people find that optimistic and helpful.
Yeah, because life can feel like we are a puppet and we are just responding to what happens around us. And if it rains outside, then we're sad. If a person sends us a message, then we're annoyed. And that we're just these sort of reactive creatures reacting to whatever happens around us. But you're telling me that if I have a greater understanding of the brain and how it works and emotions, then I can seize back some of that control and live a more intentional life.
Yes, exactly. And I think for me, I mean, I started my career studying the nature of emotion, but really it became a flashlight into understanding how a brain works. Why do we even have a brain? It's a very expensive organ. That piece of meat between your ears is the most expensive, metabolically, the most expensive organ you have. So What's it good for? What's its most basic function? How does it work in relation to the body? I think that certainly on your show, you've had a number of people who talk about the relationship between the brain and the body in some way. But I think scientists for a long time forgot or ignored the fact that the brain is attached to a body, right? Because we don't feel all the drama. Like right now, in you, in me, in all of our listeners, right? We all have this like drama going on. It's really quite intense and there's a lot of going on and none of us are aware of it, I hope. If you are aware of it, I'm really sorry. It probably means that something is, you know, you're not feeling well today. But it's a good thing that we're not aware of what's going on inside our own bodies most of the time because we'd never pay attention to anything outside our own skin again, right? Mm-hmm. But the problem is that in science, it often begins with starting with your own subjective experience and then trying to formalize that. And I mean, if you look at any science, physics is like that too. You just have to go back several hundred years or maybe a little longer to see it. And so it turns out that a lot of what you experience as properties of the world, of the way the world is, really is very rooted in your brain's regulation of your body. And so I guess I started with emotion, but it really became a much larger project to try to understand, well, what is a brain? How is it structured? How did it evolve? How does it work? What's its most basic function? And where do thoughts and feelings and actions, perceptions, what role do they play in that function? So it's a bit flipping the question, right? Most people start with, what is an emotion? What is a thought? What is a memory? They define it, and then they go looking for its physical basis mm-hmm. in the brain or in the body. That's a pretty bankrupt perspective. After 100 years, there weren't really good answers. So we flipped it around, and we said, okay, well, given that we have the kind of brain we do, what can it do? What does it do? And in its normal functioning, how does it produce mental events? That in our culture, our thoughts and feelings and perceptions and actions, in other cultures, they're different conglomerations of features, right? So for us, a thought and a feeling are super distinct. We experience them as very separate. In fact, really, since the time of Plato, we've had this kind of narrative where, you know, the mind or the brain is a battleground between your thoughts and your feelings, right? Mm-hmm. In for control of your action. If your thoughts win, you are a rational creature. You are a healthy creature. You are a moral creature. If your instincts and your emotions win, you know, your inner beast, then you are irresponsible, you are childish, you are immoral, you are mentally ill. That's the narrative that we work in. In some cultures, thoughts and feelings are not separate. They're really, it's not that you have them at the same time, it's that they are one thing. They are features of the same mental event. In some cultures, your body and your mind are not separate. There are no separate experiences for a physical sensation versus a mental feeling. They're really one thing. So our minds are not the human nature. It's just one human nature. And there are other human natures too. And we have to figure out how general brain plan, a general body plan for a neurotypical human produces such wide variation depending on the cultural context in which it grows.
As it relates to neuroscience and understanding the brain and the way that we create reality, was there a eureka moment for you where you realized that most of us have it wrong or that there's an underlying misconception about the way that our brain creates our reality?
I would say, yeah, sure, there was a eureka moment, but it was a long, slow burn. When I was a graduate student, I wasn't studying emotion. I was studying the self. How do you think about yourself? What is your self-esteem like? How do you conceive of yourself, right? This is an important topic in psychology. And I was measuring emotion as an outcome variable, and the measurements weren't.
As we explore the intricate relationship between our brain's functioning and our emotional experiences, Let's delve into how understanding these dynamics can empower us to reshape our responses to the challenges we face in life.
It's error. There's another name in psychology for taking in prediction error.
Exposure therapy?
Learning.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, exposure therapy, which is a kind of learning.
Yeah.
All learning is you taking in prediction error, signals you didn't predict, or there's no signal that you did predict. You predicted a signal, it's not there. So what you do is you set up situations for yourself that you will take in signals that are novel, right? And this seems like an easy thing to do. People actually sometimes seek novelty, all right? But too much novelty, it is not necessarily a good thing all the time, particularly if, you know, you're metabolically, it's expensive metabolically to take in prediction error and learn something new. Like the biggest costs that your brain expends energy on are moving your body, learning something new, and dealing with persistent uncertainty. Those are really expensive things for us. So if you're metabolically encumbered in some way, say you're depressed, or you have anxiety disorder, or maybe you have heart disease or diabetes, or you're living under chronic stress, you don't have the spoons necessarily to take in prediction error. You're just going to go with your predictions. You aren't going to learn. You aren't going to be able to update those predictions.
You're going to be stuck.
You're going to be stuck in your head, right? Every experience, every action, a combination of the remembered present, the remembered past, the predictions, and the sensory present. But the sensory present is there just to select which remembered past you're going to act on. And sometimes, in moments of great metabolic load, the brain just goes with its own predictions and ignores what's out there in the world.
I was thinking earlier on as you were speaking about this sort of social contagion where we can apply meaning to our lives and what happened to us and then consequently make ourselves sad because we see how other people on TikTok or Instagram are feeling. And it made me think that you must think the world is crazy to some degree. You must see social contagion in the world where suddenly everybody becomes traumatized because trauma's become almost popular, you know, to think about what happened to you and create meaning to it and then suffer that meaning. But there's other types of social contagion which are spreading through society. I mean, young people are getting more and more anxious. They're getting more and more depressed. We're self-diagnosing ourselves with different illnesses and different things. But now you've explained to me how the brain works. I'm thinking, gosh, as a society, we are bonkers.
Well,
we're living out lies.
Yeah, I guess the way I do find it frustrating at times, but only because I think we are meaning makers. Animals are meaning makers. We create meaning. We create meaning by virtue of living, like by virtue of interacting with things in the world, by interacting with each other. Very few meanings are given that they exist independently of us. And so what I find frustrating is that there's a lot of suffering. And understanding these basic operating principles of the brain will not remove all suffering. But it could ameliorate, it could remove some. And people don't understand that they are sometimes making their suffering worse than it has to be.
You paused on the word responsible.
Well, I want to be really clear that, again, I'm not saying people are to blame. Culpability and responsibility are not the same thing. Culpability is blame. Are you blameworthy? Right? I'm not saying people are to blame for their own suffering. I'm saying that people can be more responsible by taking more responsibility, they could reduce their suffering some. that's not the same thing as saying, you know, it's their cause to begin with. So I'll give you an example. Social contagion. Contagion is an interesting word. It means that you are infected by something. Even a virus. There are these experiments that were done 15, 20 years ago where these are done by Sheldon Cohen, who is a psychoimmunologist, which means he's a psychologist and he studies how immunology, that is your immune system, is related to your psychological state. And so what he did across a number of experiments is he took people and he sequestered them in hotel rooms. And then he took the same dosage, the same concentration of virus, and he put it in every person's nose. And then he controlled how much they slept, how much they ate. He measured their symptoms. He like weighed their tissues after they blew their nose. I mean, like he did, right? Just really, 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 really careful metrics. And across these experiments, somewhere between 20 to 40% of people became symptomatic with respiratory disease. That means the virus is necessary, but it is not sufficient to cause illness. Another necessary but not sufficient cause is the state of each person's immune system. Mm-hmm. That is, your brain and your immune system have to be in a particular state in order for you to be infected by a virus in these experiments. So the point that I'm making here is exactly the same about suffering. So let's take anxiety, for example. You know, we, in a culture, we automatically make meaning of certain types of signal patterns as anxiety. When there's a lot of uncertainty, there's an increase in norepinephrine and some chemicals in the brain. That often goes with an increase in heart rate and so on. And we automatically make meaning of this physical state as anxiety. But exactly the same physical state could be determination. It could be just pure uncertainty. Again, meaning making is about action, right? So when you are experiencing high arousal, even if it's super unpleasant as determination, you do something different than if you experience it as anxiety or uncertainty. So here's an example. There are people who experience test anxiety. Really serious test anxiety prevents people from finishing courses or graduating from college. People who graduate from college have a lifetime trajectory of earning that is hundreds of thousands of dollars more often than somebody who drops out of college. So test anxiety, over the long run, it's more than just a bit of discomfort. You know, it has serious implications for your earning potential across your life. Mm-hmm. There are these experiments that were done where they trained people to make sense of high arousal physical states, not as anxiety, but as determination. And these people learned to do this. First, they practice like a skill. It's like driving. At first, it's really hard. You have to give a lot of effort to it, but you practice, 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 and then eventually becomes really automatic. And then what happens? They're able to take tests. They're able to pass tests. They're able to continue taking courses and so on. I watched this actually happen right in front of my eyes. My daughter, when she was 12 years old, she was testing for her black belt in karate.
As we explore the importance of social connections and daily routines in managing our mental health, let's dive into some practical strategies that can help us create a more supportive environment for ourselves and those we care about.
And then we basically came up with a daily routine, which she participated in making, to see if we could put her on a different trajectory, you know? And that involved everything from getting off social media.
Because
first of all, she was using, like a lot of kids do, she was using her screens late at night. And at that point, and again, this was something I just happened upon, right? But it actually at a National Cancer Institute meeting, you know, we have retinal ganglion cells. We have cells in our retina that regulate circadian rhythm, and they're sensitive to light at the wavelengths that comes from your screen, from a screen. So if you look at those screens at night, your brain thinks it's daytime, like your circadian rhythm. You give yourself a circadian rhythm disorder, basically, and it will be harder to get into a regular sleep cycle, and you need that regular sleep cycle in order for toxins to clear and in order to consolidate what you've learned during the day so that you can remember it later. And there are a whole bunch of restorative things happen during deep sleep that you really need. And if you can't get enough deep sleep, that will make your budgeting problems worse, basically. So we targeted her. We got her off social media. Well, first of all, off screens after, you know, like 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, no screens. Off social media to reduce social uncertainty, social stress. I got up with her at 5:30 every morning. Made her breakfast, sat with her while she ate breakfast. So made sure that she was eating nutritious food, not pseudo food, like, you know, Pop-Tarts and shit like that. We had to start her like exercising again. So she started to walk long distances. She started doing Pilates, like not Pilates on a mat, but like Pilates with a reformer that would make anybody cry, you know?
Why exercise as it relates to this budget? And the metabolic functions.
Because exercise exercise throws your, it's like your brain, it's like you're throwing yourself out of metabolic balance so that the brain can learn to get itself back in. You're basically improving the resilience of your physical systems is basically the way to. So she's not, you know, she needed something more like interval training, which is what these Pilates classes were, as opposed to, you know, practicing to play tennis or whatever. Something that would where she, you know, after a certain period of time, she'd be dysregulated metabolically, and then she'd drink water and, you know, eat something healthful. And then her system basically was learning to become more flexible again. Not so stuck. Mm-hmm. So again, it was like dosing with prediction error, or like providing the brain with opportunity to learn that it was wrong. And then omega-3s. So we took, I can't remember the exact dose, but I dosed it out, high omega-3s, low omega-6s. With her doctor's permission, we also used a baby aspirin once a day on a full stomach to reduce systemic inflammation. Before bed, we had always done like a cuddle, you know, like when she was little, we would read a story or whatever. And in her early adolescent years, you know, she rejected that. And then we brought it back. So an hour before bed, we would either me or her dad, sometimes all three of us, we would read a book together, or, you know, he would read a book to us, or we would sit and talk, and she would tell me, you know, all the things that were happening at school that she could remember. And sometimes they were really horrible. And I just had to empathize. That was really hard for me because I just wanted to fix it. I just wanted to fix it. And it was really, I had to really draw on my own, experience as a therapist to just sit with the distress and empathize rather than say, do this, do this, do this, do this. It took me a long time to learn that, and I'm still sometimes struggling with that.
Why was that important?
Because then she feels heard and she feels understood. And it took me a long time to learn this. When she would tell me that, you know, someone had done something terribly mean, if I did anything other than empathize, she would feel like I hadn't heard her. And social support is a major, I mean, we are the caretakers of each other's nervous systems. Humans are social animals. It's hard to believe. I think in a culture like ours, where we're so individualistic, right? And it seems like a political statement or something. It doesn't really matter what your political views are. We evolve the way we evolve, man. We are social animals. We affect each other metabolically. We can add savings and we can add taxes. And, you know, the best thing for a human nervous system is another human. The worst thing for a human nervous system is another human.
The wrong one.
There are so many experiments showing such, I mean, I just saw a set of experiments from one of my former postdocs that was just amazing, where she looked at glucose metabolism in mothers and babies. And I think she also did it in dating partners, if I'm not mistaken. And she looked at them alone and then together, like alone during a task and then together during a task. And mothers and babies that are attached well, they're actually, their glucose metabolism is more efficient, like literally more efficient. And I believe she also showed this with dating partners too. You know, there are these studies, these old studies showing that, you know, it's like less calorically demanding to walk up a hill with a backpack if you're with a friend than if you're with a stranger. And I mean, like, there's all these really batshit crazy findings but if you realize that humans are literally affecting each other on a physical basis, whether they're aware of it or not, whether they intend it or not, it's completely irrelevant, or it's unnecessary, I would say, to have that effect, to have the effects be there. Then it starts to make sense. You know, like the idea that, and again, meta-analyses show that you will live years longer, years on average, years longer, if you have a social life filled with people who you trust and who trust you.
So is that why you got the family around just before bed? Because it was regulating her nervous system, her body.
Yeah. Sometimes she still says this to me, actually. She'll say, "Can you just be my friend for a minute and not my mother?" I'll be like, "Yes, I can." And then I actually have to do it, which is sometimes hard. Or I will say to her, this is for parents, anybody who has an adolescent or an adult child, this is like one of my, I don't know how I came up with this, but it's like golden, right? I say to her, I'm having a mother moment where I feel the need to nag you about something. And if I can just nag you for a minute about it, I won't need to tell you again. So I'm basically asking her permission. Can I tell you this thing, which I really want to tell you? And I know you don't want to hear it, but you would be doing me a real kindness if you would just listen to me for a minute. And I know it's me.
Now that we've explored the importance of social connections and their impact on our well-being, let's shift gears and delve into how small changes in our daily habits can lead to significant improvements in our lives.
I often talk about 1% improvements, and when I look at Exeter, to me, it's the culmination of so many 1% improvements on the traditional wallet. So if you're looking for an upgrade, head to Exeter.com and use code STEVEN for an additional 10% off their spring sale, which ends on May 19th. Head over there now and check it out. And you also get free shipping and a 100-day trial. That's Exeter.com with code STEVEN. I wanted to ask you about something I heard you say, and I've actually had other guests on my podcast say it, and I wasn't ever sure if it was true until I heard you say it, which is that we can change our emotions by smiling. Because if the brain is predicting, then presumably if I do a big smile and I go, yes, then the brain is going to predict good feelings and going to cause good feelings, et cetera, et cetera, and going to cause me to feel nice about myself.
Well, yes and no. I think, you know, people smile when they're not happy too. Mm. People smile when they're angry. People smile when they're plotting the demise of their enemy. You know, people smile for all kinds. People smile when they're afraid.
But can I make myself happier technically by smiling?
The meta-analytic evidence suggests that there is a slight effect, that there's a small... Yeah, yeah. Crinkle your ifta. Crinkle. There you go. It's like put a pencil between your teeth. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Now smile. Now crinkle. Okay. So it's like that. So what I would say is it's a minuscule effect size. Like, it's very small.
I do feel happier.
Do you?
Yeah.
But that's because I made you do something silly, maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
Okay. But anyways, the point being that it's overblown as an effect. I think there's a small, my recollection is that the last meta-analysis I read was that there was a small effect, but a small effect means it doesn't work for everyone and it doesn't work always. It's just really, really a very, very small effect.
You must have a perspective on ADHD, which has become a huge topic of conversation in society. I was diagnosed with ADHD. I don't necessarily take it to mean anything because I've seen so many variations of ADHD in my friends. But there's been this big rise of ADHD, and linked to the work that you've done on the brain being a predictive tool.
So my general response is the following, that there's a rise in people self-diagnosing and in using diagnosis as an explanation for behavior or for why people experience what they experience or whatever. Diagnoses are not explanations of anything. They're descriptions. They don't explain anything. And to treat a diagnosis like it's an explanation is a form of essentializing, which is not a good thing. Okay, it means that you're assuming that there's some kind of underlying, unchanging essence which is responsible for. In fact, there is something called psychological essentialism where you don't even know what the essence is, you just assume it's there and that it's the cause of all these symptoms. But a diagnosis is just a description of symptoms. And diagnoses are mostly useful for billing hours of treatment. They're not optimized for pockets, describing pockets of behavior that are, you know, or collections of behavior that tend to go together.
Because people sometimes think that serotonin and dopamine are the reason why someone has ADHD. That's like one of the theories that I've...
So there are multiple serotonin receptors. There are multiple dopamine receptors. They don't all do the same thing. Serotonin doesn't do one thing. Dopamine doesn't do one thing. Does different things in different places of the in the body and the brain, depending on what the receptors are. And also, every resource of resilience and every symptom of difficulty has a context to it. There are requirements, the way our society is structured, there are requirements for sitting and paying attention to something for long periods of time. Mm-hmm. And that requirement is hidden in the background. It's there so frequently that we forget that that's the conditional, that's the condition upon which diagnoses are made. So whatever, first of all, ADHD is not one set of symptoms. It's a variety. There's a lot of variation in the way that you can have different symptom profiles and have the same diagnosis because it's just descriptive and there are lots of symptoms. Some of those symptoms also occur they overlap with other syndromes, other diagnostic clusters. But the point is that when you diagnose someone, it makes it sound like that's a property of that person.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's a property of a person in the context that they're in.
And social expectation by many respects, like, can he pay attention in school?
Well, right. And the way that school is organized is, you know, you sit for long periods of time. Well, it may be that there are other circumstances in which not holding your attention on one thing for a long period of time could be advantageous. So my point is that there are very few things that are just categorically good or categorically bad. There's always a hidden condition.
Sure.
There's always a hidden context. And so I think it's really important to foreground that context.
You're not broken. You're just, your suitability to a certain context has been deemed to be doesn't fit.
It's not productive for that context. And that may sound like weasel words, or it may sound, you know, but it's not, because it's important that competencies are by context. And again, I would say, this is not, you know, being a bleeding heart, you know, progressive or whatever. I mean, I am a bleeding heart progressive, but this is not an example of that. This is an example of me being pragmatic.
You can regulate each other, something you talked about earlier on, which I found really, really interesting. I was reading about a study where of 25,000 people, and they found that people having a heart attack were 14% more likely to survive if they were married. But the other thing that I found interesting is that we regulate each other with words. And I think you did a study on assessing the power of words to facilitate emotion. It was a study you co-authored.
Well, we've studied the power of words in many contexts, including words as invitations to make sense of, you know, so if an instance of emotion is you making meaning of what is going on inside your body in relation to the world, then every time you use an emotion word, you invite people to make meaning in that way.
So you've proven then that certain words can calm us down.
Well, yes, but I wouldn't say I've proven anything. Scientists don't, you know.
Shown, demonstrated.
Yeah, demonstrated in a context, right? Like scientists don't like the F word, I like the other F word, but that fact. That's a tough one because it means something that holds under all circumstances in all contexts. And that's very rarely the case. So, but yes, we have. So if you've done it probably a million times. You text things to people, do you not?
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you text a couple of words to your partner or your friend, you can change their heart rate. You change their breathing rate. You can change all kinds of chemicals, all kinds of protein synthesis, just with a couple of words. Again, you know, we live in free speech is important. Freedoms are important, but freedoms come with responsibilities. Like it or not, we regulate each other's nervous systems in all kinds of ways, including with words. And
for better or for worse.
For better or for worse.
As we explore the nuances of our identities and the impact of our actions, let's shift our focus to how these insights can empower us to make meaningful changes in our lives.
Now they're in the forefront of your attention because I just mentioned them. So what I would say is that there is no essence to who you are. You are what you do. In the moment, you are what you do. And you can change what you do. You can change what you experience, the consequence of the lived experience, which is the consequence of what you do, by what you remember and what the context is. So that's my answer. If you always remember that, you will never be attached. You will never crave or strive, you know, to have things and like all of these artificial things which prop up the illusion that you are and you have an essence to you that you that, you know, is unchanging across situations.
Yeah, we are very quick to fall into the trap of thinking we are what we did. And that's I much prefer I am what I do, because that means that I have agency to make a different decision in the moment, irrespective of what I did in the past. But that's the trap we fall into. In 10 minutes time, I bet I'll be downstairs and I'll be back into the trap of thinking that I am Stephen Bartlett, who did this thing for 32 years or did, you know. Lisa, thank you. Thank you so much thank you for everything that you do. You've changed my mind in a really profound way. And that's quite hard because I sit here quite a lot. So I have lots of conversations about the brain and about lots of new studies that have come out, et cetera, et cetera. But you've completely changed my mind and made me think in a completely different way, which I'm really grateful for. So thank you so much, because that's a gift. And that's not a gift that I always get doing this job, but it really is a gift. And it's one that I think will help me to live a better life ultimately, but hopefully also for everybody that's listening. And thank you for stepping into the public communication side of your life, because I was going to say it's someone that knows what you know and that has done the work that you've done. It is so important to the extent that I almost consider it to be like a really critical responsibility, because there's people like us that sit on these podcasts who aren't in the laboratory, that are getting our information from social media, TikTok, or any odd person that says anything. And it's really, really important that people like you step out more and share what you know. And thank you so much for writing these books, because they are absolutely brilliant. And just like you've changed my mind today, I think these books will change a lot of people's lives. I highly recommend this book, How Emotions Are Made. I'm going to link it below, The Secret Life of the Brain. And also for something a little bit shorter, but equally accessible, this book here, 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. Thank you so much.
We're done. Thank you so much.
I'm going to let you into a little bit of a secret. You're probably going to think me and my team are a little bit weird, but I can still remember to this day when Jemima from my team posted on Slack that she'd changed the scent in this studio. And right after she posted it, the entire office clapped in our Slack channel. And this might sound crazy, but at the Diary of a CEO, this is the type of 1% improvement we make on our show. And that is why the show is the way it is. By understanding the power of compounding 1%, you can absolutely change your outcomes in your life. It isn't about drastic transformations or quick wins. It's about the small, consistent actions that have a lasting change in your outcomes. So 2 years ago, we started the process of creating this beautiful diary, and it's truly beautiful. Inside, there's lots of pictures, lots of inspiration and motivation as well, some interactive elements. And the purpose of this diary is to help you identify, stay focused on, develop consistency with the 1% that will ultimately change your life. So if you want one for yourself or for a friend or for a colleague or for your team, then head to thediary.com right now. I'll link it below. This has always blown my mind a little bit. 53% of you that listen to the show regularly haven't yet subscribed to the show. So could I ask you for a favor? If you like the show and you like what we do here and you want to support us, the free, simple way that you can do just that is by hitting the subscribe button. And my commitment to you is if you do that, then I'll do everything in my power, me and my team, to make sure that this show is better for you every single week. We'll listen to your feedback. We'll find the guests that you want me to speak to, and we'll continue to do what we do. Thank you so much.
That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram and visit our website www.podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.